Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling. He's Leighton Kling. Coming up on today's show, O'Reilly gets their turn in the spotlight for auto parts retailers as they release earnings this week. We also have sales updates from Target and a potential deal falling through with a private equity firm. We'll talk about that in the second half of the show. Our interview guest, Nicole Amsler, she's the VP of Marketing at Formation. It's a great interview. We're going to discuss the difference between personalization and segmentation. A lot of people throwing around the personalization term, especially with all the glut of online shopping that's happening right now. She's going to shine some light on some myths that a lot of people have regarding what really individualization or personalization is versus segmentation, which is really what most retailers are doing. It's a fantastically insightful interview. Be sure to stick around for that. A reminder, you can like us or rate us however you access us, whether that be on your podcast listening app, like, for example, Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Also, you can check us out on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast. So we begin today's show with O'Reilly. You know, once every quarter, we like to cover one earnings call from an auto supply retailer. We try to rotate it around between Advance and AutoZone. It's O'Reilly's turn this week. We expected somewhat of a decline in sales at O'Reilly as a result of COVID-19. However, they're still open. They're still an essential retailer in most parts of the country. And with the swell of people taking on those DIY projects, we've talked about the likes of Ace, Home Depot, and Lowe's seeing that traffic. We wondered if the same would be true of people taking care of their vehicles. And as it turns out, at least with regard to O'Reilly, the same, not true so far.
As we look through the numbers for this retailer, the standout number was a rare comp store sales decline of 1.9% during their fiscal 2020 first quarter. O'Reilly is notorious for steady increases in comp sales, and it's rare, it's very rare to see over the past 5 years a decrease. According to the company, things weren't great in the first 2 months of 2020, even before COVID-19, which is pretty alarming. This was blamed on fairly mild weather, meaning sales for cold weather-related products were low through most of the United States. These products include antifreeze, of course, and batteries, which they specifically noted on the call itself as areas that were depressed somewhat by the mild weather. At the same time, they noted sales picking up in the spring with earlier than usual warmer temperatures throughout the country, allowing some customers to get a head start on spring maintenance needs for their vehicles. Just as sales were picking up, things went south after stay-at-home orders were released. Although auto parts retailers were generally allowed to stay open, people did not flock to them the same way they flocked to home improvement stores and grocery stores. In fact, during 1 4-week period from mid-March to mid-April, their comp sales declined a whopping 13%. We should note that comp sales include e-commerce sales, since most e-commerce orders end up touching the store in one way or another. Also, they discounted sales from Leap Day, sales to team members, and sales to independent parts stores. Although the first quarter for O'Reilly ended March 31st, the negative impact during the last 2 weeks in March was enough to drag their comps for the entire quarter into the red. They noted a rough sales start to April as well, and uncertainty surrounding the potential recovery timeline for auto parts retail as reasons they chose to withdraw guidance for the rest of the year, as so many other retailers that we've reported on have done. And while comp sales took headlines and really caught our eye here, they did show total sales growth of 2.7% for the company. This is due entirely to sales from new locations that hadn't obviously previously reported for the prior fiscal year. And this was enough to overpower losses on the comp front. And if you look, Trent, their breakneck pace of openings might see some slowing down due to COVID-19, but it was a major driver behind their top line growth here in an otherwise forgettable quarter. They did do a great job of breaking this down on the call itself. Impacts from negative comps were $44 million. Impacts from closed stores, around $2 million. These were offset by a $52 million benefit from sales from those newly opened locations a $34 million increase from Leap Day, and a $26 million increase in non-comp, non-core store sales. And these include such things as machinery or wholesale sales to independent parts stores. And speaking of openings, they managed to open 73 net new stores, and it really feels as though they are still on track to open 180 net new stores in 2020, even with COVID-19 headwinds. And if you know anything about development, typically development for a new store starts way before you break ground. And so they usually have to pull through with the stores currently in development. And that's one of the reasons why they will probably still hit their mark for those 180 net new stores. They did note that it is a possibility that staffing these new stores may be a bit of an obstacle if pressures from COVID-19 continue for much longer. The suggestion that people may not be either willing to work or work as essential workers, or that their typical staffing process may be affected, are all reasons to kind of be concerned about being able to fulfill these job requirements.
Now, on that note, one other thing they noted in terms of expansion on the call is that COVID-19 is expected to impact their expansion of distribution centers as well. They did open a new distribution center in the Nashville metro area during the quarter. And they said Nashville is an area where they're seeing a lot of positive sales. They have great brand momentum in that particular market. They wanted to continue that. They were actually planning on opening a distribution center later this year in Memphis, which is a similar area, not too far away from their Springfield, Missouri headquarters that they're seeing a lot of momentum in. However, this distribution center, which was supposed to be located in Horn Lake, Mississippi, just south of Memphis, is now likely to open in 2021 as they continue to experience delays. It was supposed to open in the fourth quarter of this year. Now, this won't impact their current store opening trajectory, but they did say it might affect the volumes other distribution centers are handling until that Memphis area distribution center is up and running. The reason the distribution centers are so important and have become so important for O'Reilly is those e-commerce sales that Layton was discussing. Because they do so much of their fulfillment through stores, through local distribution centers, when they open a new distribution center in a particular market, it gives them the option to offer more specific parts and maybe a little bit more obscure parts in those areas versus some of the other areas that maybe don't have that distribution center there. So it might handcuff those stores just a little bit. Also might handcuff the amount that they're able to put on their e-commerce website or even make available through the stores on a quick 1 to 2 day turnaround if there's any type of delay there. Now, with sales on a per location basis falling, as Layton talked about with those comp sales falling, it's natural to wonder if they took an equivalent hit on the margin front as well. Their CEO, Greg Johnson, on the call noted that various measures are being taken to control costs on a store-by-store basis because of that lack of traffic that they're seeing. Now, these measures include a reduction in store hours, which, of course, leads to a reduction in hours to staff and a slight cut to certain utilities, electric chief among them, and especially in warmer markets. If you can cut off that AC a little bit earlier, or at least cut that temperature higher a little bit earlier, there's going to be a benefit there. And a lot of O'Reilly stores are in the southern United States where you're starting to see those temperatures go up. Most stores for O'Reilly typically open until 9 or 10 p.m. They're now closing most of their locations at 7:30 p.m. Additionally, on a corporate level, they're delaying capital investments the company is deeming discretionary. There's still room for adjustment, said Johnson, at least on the call, as things move forward. So there are still some levers there to pull. They haven't cut back entirely what they could be cutting back, and they're just kind of leaving it on a week-by-week basis a little bit as they appraise the situation. Now, the sum here was $3.97 diluted earnings per share in this year's fourth quarter. Their quarters are a little bit offset versus $4.05 a year ago. So an 8-cent drop-off doesn't look that bad, but it does look slightly worse when you consider there are around 4% fewer shares outstanding today than 12 months ago because of their share repurchase program. By the way, they did halt that program in this release as well. There are positives, though, surrounding the bottom line. For example, when you break things down, their gross profit actually increased over a year ago by 1%. The real culprit here, when you look at the bottom line, was selling, general, and administrative expenses. And they said, hey, look, a lot of these costs are fixed, so they're going to increase. They had already planned on an increase, and it did increase by 5% on an absolute basis over last year's first quarter. You look at that, and it's because they're opening a new distribution center, they're opening more stores. That makes sense. But as a percentage of sales, it increased 60 basis points as well. But it's important to keep all of these numbers as far as their bottom line in perspective, because their net income still came in at $300 million for the quarter. So it's not like COVID-19 is pushing them into the red or even anywhere close. So despite all of these pressures, they're still coming in at a net income mark at 12.1% of sales. That's a number most retail CEOs out there would kill for. They would love to be able to see that type of a number at 12.1% of sales. So their margins are still really good. So really, to summarize the numbers on the call, due in part to their SG&A increasing and due in part to some deleveraging of efficiencies on the store level, as a result of those reduced comps, that reduced traffic, their net income fell from 13.3% of sales to 12.1% of sales. Not bad overall, considering those pressures in late March. But Leighton, they also went into some of the things that they're looking ahead to, even though they said it's very, very tough to forecast in this environment.
That's right. They certainly did. And it is a tough time to be talking about the future. But although O'Reilly doesn't typically expand too much on trends they are seeing between the end of the fiscal year and the earnings call, they did on this version, at least. CEO Greg Johnson said, over the past week, they've actually seen an uptick in sales from previous weeks. They've attributed this largely to the economic impact payments from the CARES Act. However, they did caution that it is far too early to determine if the momentum from these payments will continue into May, and said the uncertain benefits from these payments to their customers is one of several reasons why they removed guidance for the rest of the year. Auto parts stores in general are in an interesting place in the marketplace, especially right now when people are economically depressed, Trent. They tend to put off car maintenance, at least some of that short-term maintenance there, because if your car is able to go from A to B, then it is fine right now. Money should be spent elsewhere. However, this also means that people may be more willing to take on immediate repairs themselves rather than paying mechanics to do so who may not be customers of a retailer like O'Reilly. As a result, O'Reilly and other auto parts retailers sometimes see a loss in sales of discretionary products, but an increase in sales of other products that assist customers with immediate needs during recessionary periods of time. And while we can't say 100% that a recession is coming, we have seen signs of recessionary buying habits from some of the population. And I personally think a recession is coming and that they should be prepared for such an event. This is actually something that they did point out on the call, management did. Historically, they are able to bounce back sales-wise versus many other retailers. And I know this is anecdotal, but I visited an O'Reilly about a month ago, Trent, and this is right after they reduced their store hours for the week. And I did notice that traffic was slightly up, and this was according to store management there. Traffic was up, but people's purchases were a little bit different. So it sort of speaks to that general outlay of maybe seeing a different expectation of what inventory you're going to sell through. Other general trends they noted was professional sales, or sales to professional outlets, continue to outpace do-it-yourself sales in terms of growth. Again, that could be reversed going forward a little bit because of this potential recession coming up. This is something that we've seen for auto parts retailers as Advance and AutoZone also built out their professional service divisions. They noted that in part because of this, ticket growth is outpacing traffic growth. The difference between the two was actually helped along by mild winter weather and, of course, the stay-at-home orders. The professional business, however, was hardest hit by stay-at-home orders. The company did note that the demographic served by professional customers they sell products to was more likely to be working from home and therefore staying at home and, of course, not needing to make car repairs. To break this down a bit more, basically, they are saying that their professional customers serve largely white-collar markets and clients who are not essential workers. And because these clients are either working from home through remote technologies or furloughed entirely, they aren't driving their cars as much. And I certainly can see that I myself have been working from home, so not driving nearly as much in my older automobile. But because they aren't driving as much, customers in general in this particular niche, not as much is happening to their cars to necessitate having them repaired by a professional while they are working. So it will be interesting to see if O'Reilly or others in the marketplace, AutoZone, Advance, of course, launch an awareness campaign for vehicle maintenance when vehicles aren't in regular use, imploring customers to run vehicle checks if they've been idle for a longer period of time, for example.
Yeah, my vehicle's certainly feeling that. I think I've put all of 5 miles on it in the last month. Well, that'll do it for the first news segment on the Retail Focus podcast. Coming up after this break, we'll be joined by Nicole Amsler. She's the VP of Marketing at Formation. And as we teased in the introduction, she's going to talk about the difference between personalization and segmentation. Also going to talk a little bit about what some direct-to-consumer companies could be or should be doing during this time of increased traffic to their sites and to their products to make sure those customers stick around in the long run. We've seen a surge in customers turning to e-commerce, direct-to-consumer, and lifestyle brand sites as several brick-and-mortar retailers are, of course, forced to close over the last couple of months. And people are generally a little bit fearful of leaving their house, even if they can. Now, this has opened up space for the likes of Wayfair and Blue Apron to grab market share, or at least grab market share back in the case of Blue Apron. But the million-dollar, really, it should be billion-dollar question is, what can these companies do to hold that market share when things return to some semblance of normal? Here to discuss that topic and others is Nicole Amsler. She's the VP of Marketing at Formation, a company that helps businesses engage with customers through individualized offers. So first, to start out with, I was wondering if you could explain a little bit about what Formation does on the day-to-day, just so our listeners know a bit about your background and where you're coming from with these perspectives.
Oh, yeah. So Formation creates one-to-one individualized offers. Think about United Airlines and their MilePlay program. So we work with United Airlines to help create individualized offers. And what that means is I'm a frequent flyer on United. And what is interesting to me is getting an upgrade to their section with the extended legroom, where somebody else might be a MilePlay member and their interest might be upgrading to business class. And so what we do is we help them pull their customer data and interact with us on an individual level to learn what motivates us each as individuals. So what motivates me to fly with United and to activate one of their offers may be different than you or your friends or your family and my friends. So what Formation does is it helps you get that one-to-one information on an individual to give them an offer that will maximize their engagement with that offer, thus increase loyalty and hopefully increase engagement.
So I think most of our listeners probably know a bit about some of these retail trends we touched on in the introduction, but from your spot in the marketplace, what are some trends that you are seeing and you're seeing with some of the folks that you work with?
So I think the trends we're seeing, obviously, we have verticals such as airlines, et cetera, seeing a downturn in their businesses, where other retailers like grocery are seeing an uptick.
So kind of piggybacking off of that, you know, we don't know how long any of this will last, but assuming we're not cooped up in our dwellings forever, what are some of these things these companies should be doing, especially these direct-to-consumer companies that are seeing a bit more traffic now? What are some of these things that they should be doing right this instant to ensure that they remain top of mind, even when the brick-and-mortar retailers open back up?
It's about engaging with their customers and getting to know them. Like I said, customers really expect a personalized experience, and that's not going to change after everything goes back to the new normal. So brands right now that are doing really well, like Blue Apron, are seeing a high influx of people ordering food delivered to their home. The reason for that is because people don't want to go to grocery stores or feeling maybe a little bit nervous about going out in public. But what happens when people feel much more confident? So what Blue Apron should be doing right now is learning everything they can about their customers so that they can start to and continue to engage with those customers moving forward once people go back to this new normal. And so how they can do that is they really need to understand people and engage with them on an individual level. For example, Blue Apron might send out offers to men between the ages of 25 and 35 who live in California and in the San Francisco Bay Area. And they may group people in that aspect. But just because they're grouping those folks together doesn't mean every one of those people have the same interests and have the same palates for the foods they're serving. And so if Blue Apron then starts to dive deeper into each of those individuals within that San Francisco Bay Area group that they're focusing on, they may find that Nicole really loves steak, where Trent really likes vegan food. And so by engaging and getting to know their customers over time, they can start to individualize the offers that are sent to these folks. And then that will increase engagement, which will then increase loyalty. So I think the bottom line is they need to focus on building trust and building loyalty with those consumers right now.
You're not wrong. I actually do really enjoy most vegan offerings there. But I'm glad you talked about personalization, because that brings me to this. A lot of these brands are seeing customers now for the first time. You gave the example of Blue Apron. They're taking someone's online order really for the first time. What are some things that they can do to quickly ramp up to get an accurate, full view of who that customer is and what they want?
Well, it's not just about what they say and what they do on the front end that consumers see. It's also what they do on the back end. So in order to really develop true one-to-one personalization, somebody like Blue Apron is going to need to invest in a personalization platform that has artificial intelligence and machine learning in order to scale. Because most platforms out there right now only allow them to segment into groups. And in order to really understand a person and what they're looking for, they need to engage with that person on an individual level. So that means if they're engaging with you, Trent, that means they send you an offer. And based on how you engage with that offer, they learn from that. And then they send you a different type of offer. And what happens is they send you an offer and they fine-tune their offers over time until they get to offer that you are interested in. And that's how they learn about you. Rather than sending you a blanket offer that says, okay, Trent, get 25% off our service for the next 2 months, it may not be about money for you. It may be the fact that you want a vegan option. So if they sent you another offer that said, hey, Trent, get 20% off, or not even 20% off, hey, Trent, join us. We have a whole list of new vegan items in our menu. Try us for free for a month, whatever the call to action is. And that may entice you better than a 20% off discount would.
So I'm glad we're talking about personalization here, because it's something that personalization, individualization, whatever you want to call it. If you go to a conference like NRF, you hear about retailer X and retailer Y doing a great job of this. And yet in practice, it seems like there are a lot of retailers that are just swinging and missing. So I want to get kind of away from the COVID part of it and the COVID impacts there and just talk about how retailers are implementing this. Where does individualization or personalization go wrong for a company? And what can companies begin to do to just execute better on this front?
Well, I really break personalization down into three stages. And it's about, right now, my job as a VP of marketing for Mation is to educate the market on what these three stages are. Because I think, Trent, really, people don't really know which stage they're in. They think they're doing one-to-one personalization or individualization when they're really doing what I call macro segmentation. And so macro segmentation is if you divide your audience into 5 to 10 segments, and that could be demographics only. And then I have a stage called micro segmentation when you divide your audience into 10 or 30 segments. And that gets much more complicated. It requires a ton of resources. And then when you get to the one-to-one personalization, that really requires artificial intelligence and machine learning if you're going to scale that efficiently and effectively. And so what I've been working on is really defining those stages for folks and really letting them figure out on their own which stage of personalization they lie in. And once they figure that out, they'll be able to then say, okay, what's missing? Do we have the right technology in our stack? And if we do, are we implementing it correctly? Do we have the right team members to implement this? And there's a lot of different ways that they can look at what they're doing to figure out if which stage they're in. And once they determine which stage, then they'll know what they have to do moving forward.
So it may be an instance in this circumstance where a retailer might not be cognizant of which stage that they're in and therefore might be executing improperly there on the personalization front. I did want to go back to the Blue Apron example, because they're in the spot where there's a lot of direct-to-consumer brands or brands similar to them where they operate in a bit of a more premium spot in the marketplace, a higher price point. although $10 per person for a meal that you prep might not be much in San Francisco or New York, for those in the middle of the country, it is a little bit more premium priced. And we've noted a shift towards recessionary buying habits now over the last couple of weeks with people buying substitute goods that are lower priced. So other than mass discounting, what can a company like Blue Apron do to first assess the situation that their customers might be in and then keep the attention of those who think they might not be able to afford products from them?
I want to talk about what you just said there, mass discounting. I think that's a misnomer of brands, that they often send out these huge coupons to get try to get as many customers as they can get. And what that does is it make it them those customers in the short term. But what it doesn't do is build loyalty with those customers. And it also sets expectations to assume that you're going to be sending coupons later on as well. So that is the example of what we call more of a transactional offer. So that's stage one of personalization. Really, it's about building loyalty with your customer base. Again, it's also clear that it's more expensive to find new customers than it is to retain your current customers. So I think a lot of these brands should be thinking about retention. And so again, transactional offers will bring in new people, but will retain folks, and it won't, because you really need that one-to-one personalization. And so if we start to dig into what that means it's about understanding and gaining the insight of what motivates your customer to take an action. That action could be signing up for a free month. The action could be ordering an additional meal. The action could be trying to, in the case of Blue Apron, trying a different type of meal than they usually try. And then it's about learning along the way from those customers to maintain that loyalty. Like, I haven't personally used Blue Apron, but if I did, I would want a way to have a variety of meals I could pick, and I'd want a way to be able to rate those meals and let Blue Apron know which meals I liked and which meals I don't liked. And then it would be on Blue Apron then to react to that input. And if I could see that I was having a conversation or engagement with a brand like Blue Apron and they were listening to me and adding different options for me to order, that would make me more loyal to that brand, because they're listening to me and actually getting me what I want versus just offering something blanket that they're hoping I'll want.
So oftentimes it's about looking at maybe a customer's entry point into a brand and using that as the jumping off point to kind of figure out what they want. And I'm glad you mentioned the repeat customer, because we know that usually the most expensive customer is your first time customer, but companies just don't seem to spend a whole lot on retaining those customers. And in fact, I know Formation had a recent blog post about that. And so we're kind of wondering there, in terms of customer loyalty, building that customer loyalty, what makes for an effective loyalty program, other than maybe, as you talked about, that two-way street with the brand where you feel as though the brand is really interacting and communicating with you?
I think it's all about relevancy, right? So it's all about being relevant. So wherever customers today, it's no longer a product-centric world like it used to be. It's now a customer-centric world where customers are expecting, wherever they go, via the website, via the mobile app, or even in store, that the experience is personalized to them. And there's data that shows that the more something's personalized, the more customers will spend with that particular brand, and the more loyal they will be. So it's all about that relevant experience. And I think with a Blue Apron, as an example, I think creating that relevant experience is, once a customer becomes a customer, how do you retain that customer? And you retain them by offering them relevant products, relevant communications, and relevant services. You know, a brand that does this really well is Sephora. You know, I shop at Sephora often. They have a brick and mortar store, but they also have an online store. At any moment, I can go online and I can look for a particular product that I am purchased before. And if I'm not sure if I want to buy that product, I can go into that store, and there's folks there that personalize the experience by having experts that I can ask questions. And I think that's why Sephora does so well, and they're actually opening more brick and mortar stores this year and not closing them, is because of that personalized experience that they give its consumers. I think a lot of brands, including Blue Apron, can learn from that. 20 plus years ago, there was only a certain time of the year you could go in and get discounts, right? That's how Black Friday started with Thanksgiving. But now there's always sales going on. And so now when you go to the mall, you expect to find sales everywhere you go. And so when a brand like a Blue Apron or even a Sephora, anybody else, is trying to attract new customers, like right now is a prime example. Right now, I'm not buying anything that isn't on sale, because I'm expecting everybody to have sales right now, because we're all kind of locked away and it's just a weird time. But in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, I'm buying from you now because you're having a sale, but most likely will I buy from you again? That's all going to depend on the experience you're going to provide me during this time. And so I think right now is a time where a lot of these brands out there can actually retain a lot of these customers that they normally would never have gotten, such as Blue Apron. But it's a lot of work to do that. They can't just pull them in and expect them to stay. They need to figure out why they came in the first place and see if they can then create some kind of experience for them that is going to encourage them to stay.
Some great points there. Well, once again, Nicole, thank you very much for coming on. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Trent.
We thank Nicole once again for joining us. She was fantastic to speak with. And once again, you can check out Formation at formation.ai. They've got, as I referenced in the interview, a lot of great blog posts and a lot of great white papers that are more educational and informational than anything else. It's interesting because a lot of websites you go to, they're kind of trying to sell you on their product. Nicole said they take a stance like they need to educate people more than they need to sell their product. And so I think that was really neat. And I learned certainly a lot from the several hours that I've spent on their website during that time. Well, our second news story has to do with a potential deal we were pretty bullish on for L Brands, but Leighton might be on the rocks.
Yeah, it certainly might be. The deal was originally announced in February and would have had Sycamore Partners pick up around 55% of Victoria's Secret for $525 million. And we spoke about this on the podcast, but we've been underwhelmed by Sycamore Partners' efforts on this show as a whole, as their retail deals have often been marked by controversy in the past. Their current retail holdings include Staples, former L Brands brand, The Limited, Belk, and of course, Dollar Express. As a bit of a background, let's talk about Dollar Express for a second, Trent. Dollar Express was the name born out of Sycamore Partners' purchase of 330 Family Dollar stores as part of the Dollar Tree acquisition of Family Dollar. If our guests and listeners remember, back in 2015, Dollar Tree acquired Family Dollar stores. And to get that pushed through for regulatory purchases, some of those stores had to be divested. So the stores were actually never rebranded from Family Dollar. Instead, after acquiring the stores, Sycamore Partners accused Dollar Tree of, among other things, selling them unprofitable stores, stores with direct competition from Dollar Tree, or building a new Family Dollar location near some of the locations that were sold. And while they might have had a point regarding maybe the opening of new stores near some of the sold-off locations, their arguments regarding unprofitable stores and competition pretty much fell flat. And that's something that is typically addressed in due diligence. And I think a lot of people could see that from the get-go, in that if you're buying something, it is up to you to do the proper amount of research needed to see that transaction through and to see it as a successful acquisition of those 330 Family Dollar stores. But it was a moot point, as at around the same time that lawsuit was launched by Sycamore Partners against Dollar Tree, Dollar General took over the 323 remaining locations, none of which had ever actually been transitioned to Dollar Express. Strangely, the Dollar Express logo still exists on Sycamore Partners' website as an example of their retail holdings, this around 4 years after Dollar General took over those remaining stores. Well, Sycamore is once again dealing with issues on the legal front, Trent. This time, after their claims that Victoria's Secret has not handled impact from coronavirus in an appropriate manner, therefore devaluing the brand overall. Their complaints include closing the stores, which that's kind of legally enforced in most jurisdictions right now. And by the way, a lot of malls are on complete lockdown. You can't even walk into the food court, which has retailers or restaurants where they are able to stay open right now. But you can make a real argument that the damage done by remaining open and incurring the social media wrath, let's say, that might have been a little bit more severe to the brand than actually closing the stores outright, which again, they've been forced to do outside of their control in most instances, as they really had no argument for Victoria's Secret, at least, being an essential retailer right now. Sycamore Partners argue this in a Delaware court filing, according to the New York Times, that Victoria's Secret should have stayed open or could have stayed open in most instances. They pointed to the term in the agreement that L Brands must continue to conduct business as usual, and not change any cash management policies. However, in this case, it is likely that L Brands' argument in response would simply be that this was not allowed by government authorities to remain open. L Brands has been required to close stores in many markets, but has voluntarily closed others and furloughed employees. Sycamore said in a letter to L Brands that they would have failed to operate the business in line with past practice, thus materially and irreparably damaging the Victoria's Secret business. They acknowledged that COVID-19, but honestly, they said it does not excuse the performance of L Brands' obligations under the transaction agreement. So it seems as though they're pretty much ignoring the coronavirus and the current pandemic that is affecting Victoria's Secret's core business.
Yeah, ultimately, I think looking at this when we were talking about it, this is kind of an attempt for Sycamore Partners to get out from under the deal after COVID-19 is basically crippled, especially Victoria's Secret financially. You're still seeing quite a bit of momentum at Bath & Body Works, and of course, their e-commerce sales were always fairly strong, but essentially, you're looking at a lot of sales for them of things like lotions, of hand sanitizers, and the like, whereas, again, sales of discretionary items like what Victoria's Secret sells, you're seeing a little bit of a tailback on that overall as you look at the retail landscape. Additionally, it's worth noting that the share price of L Brands has been very adversely affected by everything in the last 2 months. It was adversely affected by this announcement, in fact, by about 20%, meaning that the deal, as it was originally struck by Sycamore Partners, would have Sycamore Partners paying a sizable premium over the ultimate value of Victoria's Secret based on their market cap. But either way, whatever comes out of this, someone will get a raw deal. L Brands would get a raw deal if Sycamore Partners is allowed to break the deal. And of course, Sycamore Partners would get kind of a raw deal because they're buying a watered down company based on what they thought they were getting in the first place. Now, I would argue that that's probably through no fault of L Brands. That's more through fault of government agencies and the like closing down Victoria's Secret stores. But if Sycamore Partners was ultimately really adverse to the deal at this point, it's likely they could pay some sort of a settlement or a fee to cancel the deal if the legal action proves unsuccessful. If the deal goes through, Sycamore Partners would effectively be on the hook for these stores that weren't in a great place prior to the original deal in February, certainly in a lot less of a good place now after COVID-19 impacts. Also, it's worth noting that L Brands elected not to pay many of their April rent payments, more on another company who decided to do the same thing in our Looking Ahead segment, but that could also potentially make any future deal more difficult as far as settling up who is on the hook for those rent payments. You would think that L Brands at some point would be if those were not forgiven by landlords. And while we understand why Sycamore would take this action, I mean, why not try anything within your power to keep from purchasing a retailer that most governments have forced to close since you originally struck the deal? That makes sense. We feel as though this won't fully go to the courts. Settlement is far more likely, but it does raise the question, what will L Brands do with a brand in Victoria's Secret in rapid decline, dragging down the great cash flow they've been getting from Bath & Body Works? And also, how is this going to affect the proposed C-suite transition away from Les Wexner? That was part of this entire deal as well. And towards the very accomplished Sarah Nash, I know a lot of people were looking forward to Nash taking over the company. And you kind of wonder if this hiccup in the deal with Sycamore Partners will affect that in any way, shape, or form. Well, moving on to our final news story of the Retail Focus podcast, we're going to be looking at Target as they release a sales update mid-quarter, giving us insight on their sales once the pandemic struck or since the pandemic struck. It's really a quarterly sales update this particular quarter, running from, again, February through April. Things appear to be remarkably solid for Target right now, given this sales update. Looking back, just taking a 3 to 4 year glance at it, we think the company benefited tremendously from their work to improve their standing in grocery over the last 4 years. If you recall, 4 or 5 years ago, grocery was a problem area for Target. Stores were reporting significant shrink and stale sales in food, no pun intended, really, but they weren't seeing the growth in sales in food that they thought they would see at that point. Now, since that point, they have gradually improved their positioning in the grocery space, And that, along with their acquisition of Shipt, seemed to have put them in a solid position during COVID-19. Now, the big headline of this business update was stolen by e-commerce sales. Those were said to have rose 275% year over year. Now, we think of 60% as the benchmark for a stellar year over year increase under most conditions. But those numbers, the 275% numbers, those are mind-blowing there. Of course, so much of their fulfillment is driven by their individual stores, so this is benefiting Target on a comp sales basis. They're seeing some slowing from the panic buying days of March and April, but they still say comp sales as a whole, which include those great e-commerce numbers, are up a respectable 7% so far in the current quarter over the previous year's same quarter, again, spanning from February to April. Given these numbers, the e-commerce sales certainly appear to be propping up the lack of store traffic due in large part to the pandemic. And in fact, the company said as such in this update, in-store specific sales, so sales coming from that in-store traffic, were down to this point in the quarter, but drive up and Shipt adjacent sales really lifting the boat for Target. And we should also note that in the company's prior business update on March 25th, they said comps were up 3.8% through February. Now, based on company information, panic buying caused a surge in mid-March, saw a little bit of a back off slightly once you got into late March and April, and now it's shifting somewhat into a new normal at the end of April, at least a normal until a lot of the stay-at-home orders are lifting. And additionally, it bears noting that in most markets, their sales of apparel and other non-essential goods have been allowed to continue. So this allows them to kind of retain a privileged space in the market. Now, apparel sales are still down year over year by over 20%, so still a pretty sizable decline. But that decline could be much worse if either they weren't allowed to continue selling the clothing, as is the case in a few states, or if those clothing retailers were not closed as they are now. However, looking at the categories they excelled in, as expected, the grocery and household essentials categories have seen the greatest increase from the beginning of the quarter, sales up over 20% in each of those categories. Electronics, this is interesting, has seen an impressive boost as well, with sales of games up, but also printers. Sales of printers are up over 15%. That's the impact you see when people working from home, needing to print things out, needing to scan things as well, since many of the printers that are sold in a Target have that scanner optionality too. And I know I've been using my printer and scanner at home a lot more since being forced to work from home a couple of months ago now. Sales of hard lines as a whole increased about 16% as well, so inclusive of some of those other categories. They also saw a slight increase in the home category, although they didn't attach a percentage increase to this. And they said that due in part to sales in higher margin categories being down, like apparel, for example, and because of internal precautions and investments towards their workforce, they said, hey, you know, even though the sales look good, the margins might be squeezed somewhat this quarter, and they anticipate quite a large apparel markdown on the next call because of the timing of the pandemic and a lot of people ceasing to shop for apparel right when that spring apparel was hitting those stores.
CEO Brian Cornell said in the prepared release that they are seeing an increase in market share during the pandemic. It was also noted that the leadership team believes that their drive up and Shipt services are strengthening bonds with the consumers that they hope will linger as things begin to return to normal. Cornell said that they have actually been seeing an uptick in drive up services by a whopping 7 times in certain periods in April than pre-pandemic levels. He also mentioned that Shipt handled a greater volume on the Friday before Easter than it does in a typical week. The announcement was also used to relay the message publicly that the $2 per hour wage hike Target had previously temporarily committed to will remain in place through the end of May. It will also continue a 30-day paid leave for employees 65 or older, pregnant, or with underlying medical issues. This comes on the back of their requirement earlier this week to require all employees to wear masks. Target is providing masks to those who need them, as well as providing thermometers to employees for temperature checks. There is a group called Target Workers Unite asking for employees to call in sick May 1st in protest, saying Target isn't doing enough to protect employees, like requiring customers to wear masks, for instance. I have bad news for this group, enforcing customers wearing of masks would be an absolute mess. And Walmart, anecdotally, has some stories about that. Despite seemingly positive news, Target's share price took a hit of about 3% just after the midweek announcement. A lot of that, trend, according to headlines at least, has to do with the increase in costs because of the infrastructure you have to build out within the stores, the signage, the notes on the floor to step 6 feet away from your fellow customers, and of course the additional personnel and the services and supplies for said personnel. There are all issues that are going to increase the cost. But overall, Trent, I've been to several Targets over the past 3 weeks, and they have done a phenomenal job managing traffic, managing operations, managing everything at the front of the store, and making sure everything is wiped down, clean, sanitized. And the big thing for me, and this is always a big thing with Target that I've always expressed a positive belief in, is that their signage and their ability to convey messages to customers is honestly top notch in terms of general retail. They've done a really excellent job. Even right now, when compared to Walmart, obviously their largest competitor, they've done such a great job of, I think, truly caring for their employees and the customers coming in through their stores, but really at the same time, taking advantage of this sort of era of uncertainty with this pandemic. And that, like you said, Trent, people can come in and shop for clothes where they can't necessarily go to any other retailer right now and shop for clothing, but they have the ability to leverage what they have right now with groceries to get the people in, and then people can meander throughout the entire 100,000 plus square foot stores as they please. They're in a very advantageous position.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, a segment we call Looking Ahead, where we're keeping an eye on stories we're looking at for the next week, month, or year. And Leighton, as he so often does, is going to look towards the land of real estate, but more importantly, people maybe not paying those landlords.
That's right, Trent. Commercial real estate is often talked about on this show, as we are both passionate about the topic. This has to do with a company that is also, like Target, public traded in the Gap. And Gap warned on last Thursday, that they may not survive over the next year or so. And as a result, they're cutting back immediate cash payments for rent and other expenses. And honestly, this is huge because this will have a trickle-down effect to, we think of REITs typically on this show, carrying a lot of regional shopping centers and larger conventional malls. Well, Gap is in a lot of those spaces. And in North America alone, it would have amounted to around $115 million per month. Again, this is according to Reuters, if they had stopped paying payments, which they reportedly have. And so I think if their decision bears through and they continue to stop paying all of those immediate expenses over the next few months, we could see a Gap that is looking towards bankruptcy maybe as a way out. And I think obviously Gap is not going to be the only retailer affecting landlords. The Cheesecake Factory, near the very beginning of the pandemic, again, the Cheesecake Factory is a completely different business because they're a full service restaurant model with over 300 locations in the United States. But they said they too will stop paying payments immediately. And that was the middle of March. And so they stopped paying payments for rent in April. I think this is going, again, to have a ripple effect throughout the economy, but really speaks, Trent, to their sustainability previously as a business. The Gap has been having a number of issues. They've had inventory issues, supply chain issues, and honestly, they just have a demand issue with the business because people are no longer buying their product or see a lot of their apparel products as fashionable and on trend. So again, this is going to be pandemic related mostly because no customers are coming into their store, but this should offer them a time to really look at their core business assets and see maybe they need to downsize. They've already shut down a number of locations and failing malls throughout the country. Maybe they need to look at operations a little bit more, but I think this will be interesting because this is one retailer right now that deals with apparel how many others are also going to stop paying rent, and how many others are going to be affected by this downturn in the economy long term and potentially file bankruptcy?
Well, my looking ahead is going to look at perhaps something a little bit more optimistic. Hopefully, we hope it doesn't have negative repercussions, but states are beginning to slowly reopen retailers. Now, some people, especially the amateur doctors and amateur disease experts on social media, would say that this might be a little bit too soon, but we're seeing states like Georgia, South Carolina, Oklahoma, Alaska, even to some extent Colorado, New Mexico, Iowa, and so forth, begin to allow retailers to reopen. We even saw a pitch, certainly, that Las Vegas could maybe be kind of the petri dish for the rest of the country in terms of reopening. Now, I'm not going to look at whether this is good or bad. I'm not a doctor. I don't know this much. But what I do know is I live in a state in Colorado where they're shifting the stay-at-home order beginning this next week to a safer-at-home order, where they are recommending those that have pre-existing medical conditions, those that are elderly, those that might be higher risk of fatality from COVID-19 to stay at home while they're kind of slowly lifting restrictions on the rest of the state. Now, in many cases, it's not a wholesale lifting of restrictions. For example, in Colorado, you still can't go to bars, still can't go to restaurants. Most retailers are still closed. But they are lifting some other restrictions, allowing you to go in public as long as you have a mask on and so forth. The reason I'm looking ahead is, as this slowly takes place throughout the country, I want to know how retailers, especially those non-essential retailers that have been closed, approach this. Because as we talked about, there are certainly maintenance issues that go into reopening a retail site. But if you're doing retail to go, like for example, what is happening in some areas of Texas, or if you're able to open with limited hours or able to open limited parts of the store, how do you execute that as a retailer? Or as a retailer, do you just say, hey, we're just going to keep all stores closed until more states than not lift these orders? So I think it's going to be interesting to see on a retailer by retailer basis how they will evolve to handle this. And I think a retailer like Kohl's, who we talked about a couple of weeks ago, starting to shift their mechanisms to that online order fulfillment through the stores and allowing people to do kind of curbside pickup, they're going to be in a better circumstance than the retailers who just did blanket closures and are not looking at reopening even partially again. And part of that might be because they want to mitigate costs in terms of staffing and the like, but you're also limiting how people are going to think of you as far as the recovery is concerned. I, again, don't pretend to be able to have a crystal ball and see into the future, but one thing I can almost guarantee is going to be the case is it's not going to be a dramatic, everything is open suddenly and there are no restrictions. It's going to be a gradual deal. And are retailers going to be able to take advantage of something like that to where they can slowly start to work their way back into customers' routines on a weekly basis? And those retailers that aren't, how are they going to be adversely affected in terms of market share during the slow recovery process for the country? Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. Once again, for Layton, I'm Trent, saying so long until next week. We thank Nicole Amsler, VP of Marketing at Formation, for joining us. Our interview next week, we're going to talk about commercial real estate. We've got the sales manager for the U.S. for Crexie joining us next week. So be sure and stay tuned for that. We'll see you about 7 days from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.